Welcome to Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show. I'm Ted Bonnet.
And I'm Phil Proctor, and we have very exciting guests
today.
We do. Very unique. I'm so glad. I know they're both very busy. I'm so glad they could make it today.
Their availability is so difficult.
Very limited because they're always in demand.
Yeah.
First guest, my only guest, is sitting across the table from me, Ted Bonnet.
Hey.
Ted, how are you?
And my guest is Phil Proctor.
Yes. What a coincidence.
Well, we've been doing this show for 3 years. We figured it's time to get to know each other.
Well, it's time for our listeners to get to know us a little bit better, too, I think.
Yes.
Ted, read my book, right?
Yes.
I feel embarrassed, talking about
to
my
your book?
Brilliant book.
Yes.
But you can.
Oh, okay. This is the story. This is it. This is.
Well, I'm confused. What the hell
this
are you
is the 60s
about?
Cast in stone.
All right, what's stoned. It called? What's
Where's it called? My fortune cookie?
Why is it called that?
Because, and I doubt our listeners heard this story before, but you were caught in the crossfire of a gangland shooting.
That's right.
In San Francisco over Chinese food.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
What was your fortune cookie? Duck?
No, my fortune cookie. Yeah, no. My fortune. I ordered the duck.
Oh.
My fortune cookie said, leave now. But unfortunately, we didn't get it till afterwards. Actually, the title does not come necessarily from the fact that we survived the Golden Dragon Massacre.
Uh-huh.
The title, which was, by the way, predicted to me by a psychic friend of mine.
Well, that's something we should talk about today because we both have had encounters with other realms.
Yes, indeed. What do they call that? Traveling?
Oh, astral projection.
Astral projection.
Yeah, which I never had an interest or a proclivity for, but I had a master through actually a police acquaintance of mine.
Huh. This is an arresting story.
Yes. And she remote viewing is actually the term for
okay.
it.
Okay. Remote viewing.
And they do travel on what they call the astral. Mm-hmm. We can talk about that because I had no idea.
The old astral highway.
And it worked. It actually worked.
And how did you become interested in this?
I've been studying phenomena over the years, in my journalism career, my first job in radio. Was right at the beginning of the Hudson Valley, New York sightings.
You're talking about the UFO sightings?
Yeah. And everybody at the radio station saw UFOs. Now, it's not because everybody was partying, because we were the last freeform rock and roll radio
That's
station
radio.
In New York. We were there a full year, and then a new hire came in, a straight guy who was pretty nervous, named Howard Stern.
Oh, no.
And Howard... he would come in and he would...
What was the name of this station?
WRNW. If you saw Private Parts, the movie...
Yeah, I did voices for that.
Oh, okay. Well, there's an establishing shot of this white house in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
They went back and actually restored it, painted it, and recreated it, which was surreal for me to be in an L.A. movie theater and see my first job.
Wow.
And Howard faithfully recreated the station right down to our Israeli boss.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Which was remarkable.
I'll have to watch that movie again.
And Howard was very faithful to the way he looked and the way he acted. He was
felt that way.
He was very insecure at the time.
Impressed.
And he would do TM in his car before he'd come in. And my mentor there at the time was Joe from Chicago, who was a DJ who took the character from Fire Sign.
He was a
huge Fire Sign fan. He turned me on to Fire Sign.
Okay, wow.
And so we did a lot of out there comedy, he and I, on the air, which Howard was, I don't think awestruck is the right word. He was amazed that we would be so crazy on the air. We knew Howard when he was in, I like to say, his pupa stage.
Okay.
Where he hadn't come out of the closet on fire yet.
Yeah.
And no one saw that coming. He was always a very soft-spoken and kind person. He was really a sweet guy.
And then he got possessed by a demon, and the rest is history.
Wow, indeed. But but that's when everybody was seeing UFOs. And being a child of the space age, I had read, Project Blue Book, in the mid-60s when I was a little kid. And
what was the guy's name? Hynek?
Hynek,
right.
To me, the UFO phenomena was sort of a folkloric component of the space program because we were going to the moon, too. So
That's
it was
right.
kind
and
of
you
a,
were involved with that as well.
Well, I covered it years later. I interviewed all the astronauts who walked on the moon with the exception of Neil Armstrong because he didn't talk to anybody.
You see? Are you getting why we're talking to one another right now? over the years, I've learned amazing things about your background and the fact that you really have done many disciplines in your life, being an actual reporter and a producer. Let me ask you this. How did you trick me into doing this show?
Oh, we first met in 1977, I think, 1976. You and Peter Bergman, Procter & Bergman.
It's right before the Golden Dragon Massacre.
Yeah. Oh, before.
Yeah.
And you were touring, and you played a gig at NYU in the Village.
Right.
And Joe said, let's go. I said, great, because I hadn't seen you. And we went to see you perform. And then Joe said, after you performed, he said, let's go say hi.
Procter & Bergman.
Yeah, so we went up and said hello, and you were very accessible. And Joe said, you want to get stoned? And, of course, you two said, sure.
What a stupid question.
Yeah, and then you followed us out to Joe's car,
right,
who we were parked on the street. And you and Peter got in the back seat of the car. We were in the front seat. And we just had this really fun, scatological, genuinely polite.
Those were the days.
Having a great conversation in passing. And not knowing Peter Bergman at the time, but getting to know him and being his business partner years later, I saw Peter's essence in that moment, because as soon as that thing was burned down, he went, whoop, gotta go. He took off. So 15 years later, I'm now working on an NPR show called Heat with John Hockenberry in New York.
Right.
It was a show about
culture.
Culture and the intersection of culture and news. And we did experimental stuff, 10 hours a week, each 1 hour segments.
Wow.
It was a lot of work, eight of us doing this.
10 hours a week?
10 hours broadcast. We were on 10 to midnight live every week, and we did 2 hours every night, and each hour was its own hour.
Holy mackerel.
We worked really hard. They didn't tell us they didn't have money to go past 6 or 7 months.
That's like the Fire Centenaries hour.
Yeah. So we did the show. We were told, sorry, we're out of money, and then we won a Peabody. And through the process, I kept saying to myself, well, we're talking about art and culture. Sometimes we did. We had Ginsberg and Philip Glass in together jamming.
Cool.
We'd have, you know, George Carlin come in. You know, we had terrific guests.
Oh, yeah.
And interesting hours for sure. And I thought, you know, I'd like
you
to
do— You were doing this out of New York?
Yeah, out of New York. And I was doing a comedy improv show on the Pacifica Station.
At the same time?
Yes, WBAI, the Bernie Fleshkin show.
You were Bernie Fleshkin?
I was Bernie, yeah. Character improv. And
oh, God. How old were you? You were burning the candle at both ends.
At that point, when I started the show, I was late 20s.
Yeah, well, you could do it back then.
Yeah, when you could do it. And so getting back to— Oh, yeah. So I'm sitting there working at my desk, and this is the universe, right? I look to the right, and on the wall is a
sticker.
Sticker. You know, one of these stickies.
Paste up.
And it says, Phil Proctor, you know, 213. It was like your name and your phone number.
310.
Well, I didn't want to give it away. 555-1212.
Wait, I might have been in 213 at that point.
Who knows? So I thought, Phil Proctor, phone number.
Wow.
So I went and at our meeting, I said, how about we actually do some comedy and we'll produce it? Because Hockenberry and I were doing produced pieces, comedy bits.
Uh-huh.
I said, what if we call Phil Proctor up and see if he'll do something with us? So I called you up 15 years after we met. And I said, you know, we've met before and you have a photographic memory.
Oh,
and you
sure.
said, oh, I remember. And
I have the negatives.
and you said, oh, I'd love to do something with you. I said, there's no money. It's okay. I still love to do something with you. But
hey, and here we are still doing the same
and you
thing,
said,
but no money.
No money. You said, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. He said, do you mind if I call Peter Bergman up and see if he wants to do it? I was like, yes. And so that's how it all started.
All right. And what we're talking about is a show called Power, which is a fake soap opera series about life in Los Angeles between a high-powered lawyer and a high-powered agent, and all of the terrible things that happened to them.
The cell line was—
Because they were such terrible people.
Hollywood, the only town where you can get stabbed
in the front. That's right. And it actually, folks, is available now. If you go to the Firesign Theater website, you can get a great download of Power, of all the episodes, and a nice, wonderful little colored booklet with pictures and things at the Firesign Theater site. But here, you can get a copy of my book, Where's My Fortune Cookie, which will tell some of those stories and many, many, many more.
The hilarious, startling biography of Phil Proctor, the co-founder of the legendary satirical comedy group, the Fire Sign Theater.
I've heard of them.
And it includes over 120 rare photos.
Oh, yeah.
Illustrating
all the hot girlfriends.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did.
You were in Hollywood in the 60s, which was an entirely...
60s and 70s, man.
Man, I'd love to talk
about
that.
I was living with Jeremy Clyde out at an estate in Encino that had an Olympic-sized swimming pool. So we had these naked swimming parties every weekend. And it also had an ape cage, okay? And it had a tiki bar.
Ape cage? What, for timeouts?
An ape cage where they shot a Playboy spread. Please, don't ask. It was the 60s and the 70s. and a bomb shelter where we kept our pot, okay?
Where you get bombed.
We get bombed in the bomb shelter. And a great big house. Filled with hot and cold running girlfriends, and it was wonderful. It was friendly.
Now this was before AIDS,
yeah.
Right? It was before sex equaled death.
Yeah,
it was a whole other realm.
And it really wasn't all about sex. It was about friendships, and community. And kind of helping one another and living together in a fun and peaceful environment, I miss those days.
Yeah,
it was great. But that was what it was. That was then, and this is now.
Now we're keeping social intercourse alive.
So all of these stories and more, and all these great pictures, you can get, and to help yourself learn a little bit about the great life you probably missed. You can live vicariously through my book.
Pacific has always been a home to – it's where Fire Sign started. It's where I did my show for 10 years in New York because it was free speech.
You're going to be talking about a film that you made. It's a kind of a documentary.
Oh, it is a documentary.
It is, but it's amusing. I mean, it's a funny movie. Tell the folks about it. By the way, the title tells you a great deal. Mau Mau Sex Sex.
Yeah, and it's spelled M-A-U-M-A-U, as in the Kenyan uprising.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story of two old characters who are now gone, but in their day, speaking of the 60s, were the number one producers of adult film entertainment. But it was pre-pornography. It was exploitation films. It was like some of the worst movies ever made, I like to say, but people loved them.
But they were topless.
These guys were the ones that broke the nudity barrier. They're the ones that fought the First Amendment rights. They're the ones that took on the church and fought the church off. The big studios didn't do that.
Nope,
it was these exploiteers. Mm-hmm. And the laws were so strict that they could show nudity, not genitalia, but, you know.
No sexuality.
No
per
sexual
se.
Situations.
No sexual situations.
But they wanted the so-called jiggle factor, so they would go to nudist camps and put the models, because the real nudists were not exactly.
Necessarily, yeah. Yes, beautiful.
But they would bring in the models and just have them jump on trampolines. They made a mint. They laughed their way to the bank on the repression. Yeah. Of the American public
and
at the time.
And they made a lot of movies. How many did they make?
Oh, one every weekend. I mean, it was like...
Wow.
I mean, they would come up with an idea. They'd come up with a trailer, and they'd come up with a poster, mostly a poster.
Yeah.
And then they'd get in the plane to go fly from Chicago, where it was ice cold, Dave Friedman did at least.
Yeah.
Would fly down to Florida in the winter, where it was nice and warm, to go to the news camps, and they'd be on the flight down there with a camera crew and go, oh, wait a minute, we better write a script.
To write a script. No kidding.
That's how they operated.
What were their names?
David Friedman, who's pretty well known in those circles. He was sort of the king of exploitation. And Dan Sonny. He came from a family.
Sonny and Friedman.
Yeah, Dave Friedman and Dan Sonny.
And he comes from a policeman background.
His dad, Lewis, was the birth of exploitation. The early, early exploitation was catching criminals.
Uh-huh.
And when that didn't sell, sex sold. So he went into the sex business.
Wow.
And they would go town to town with film in their back of their cars, four wall theaters before the cops shut them down and run out of town.
Wow.
And so when I interviewed them, they were just hilarious people to me.
They are very, very funny people.
And
their relationship is wonderful. It's, you know, great old friends, but also constantly jibing one another and, you know, very funny. And did they start the Pussycat Theater here in L.A.?
Dan did. Dan Sonny came up with the name for Pussycat Theater. And that's why he died with a lot of money, because he had the brick and mortar.
Ah.
The films, not so much, but the theaters, the real estate he put together over the years.
I just love the fact that they came up with the poster in the trailer and then had to write the movies.
Yeah.
All right, so this is available?
Yeah, this is available. It came out.
Is it a download? Tell folks.
Yeah, it's a download. It's you can go to maumausex.com, maumausex.com, and you can stream it in HD. We up-resed it. It was made in 2000. It speaks to an entirely forgotten era.
Yeah.
It's a time capsule, and you'll see a lot of the movies, which are jaw-dropping.
And by the way, the Mau Mau aspect of it is that all of the ladies in Africa were topless.
Well,
right?
they were and they weren't. What happened was, this is a great film story, exploitation film story. A guy in the valley here, like in 1954, owned a Rambler dealership.
Okay.
But he loved making movies, 16-millimeter movies. So he went over to Africa to shoot wildlife.
Uh-huh.
So he
didn't shoot wildlife. He filmed.
And stumbled onto the Mau Mau uprising in Kenya.
Oh, what luck.
And he films the uprising. He films the prison camps,
the whole thing.
Comes back to L.A. And he can't sell it because it's too raw for television and it's not really interesting enough or long enough
for
film.
So there's really no platform.
So he's desperate. So where does he find himself? He finds himself in the offices of Sunny Amusement, Dan Sunny. And Dan takes a look at it and he said, yeah, I can make this work. I just thought I'd put a little sex in it. And so he takes this documentary footage, and then he had a studio down in L.A., Cordova Street, which is by the 10 and Western or something down there, and which was a whole film row at the time back in the
50s. Yeah, you show it to us in the movie.
And so they found African-American waiters and waitresses in the neighborhood and hired them to come down and put on grass skirts in front of this really cheesy backdrop and to go topless and have like a riot. He did it for the artwork, for the poster work. He just wanted the images for the poster.
Oh,
but then
God.
He said, well, might as well put it in the movie. So he just throws it randomly into the movie. And he releases it as Mau Mau, but laments the fact that it never made any money. He's on camera. He said, you know, Mau Mau don't mean nothing.
Yeah.
You put a name like Mau Mau Sex Sex on it, you make some money.
Ah, there you are.
Mau Mau Sex Sex.
Yeah.
Brand new. Everything you ever wanted to know about exploitation film and the characters behind it.
Very entertaining, really fun to watch.
That's
and there's sex sex in it.
Oh, there's sex sex in it.
Yeah.
But it's a soft, I would say an R-rated film. It's not hardcore.
No.
It's nothing like that.
And that's not even released yet. It's going to be re-released.
It played in theaters around the country.
It did play in theaters around the country,
Played Antarctica. Yep. It played every continent.
Boy, it must have melted the ice up there.
It's
probably
part
of our problem. And is it being re-released now by another company?
There's a DVD being re-released by Severin Films as a companion piece that we did the commentary track for last week.
Last week, Ted did a commentary track about the scenes in the film.
Yeah.
You know, watching for the whole movie. He did a commentary track for the whole movie. Very entertaining.
But the interesting thing about it
that'll
is
be
that
a DVD extra.
That's coming out later this year.
Yeah.
What we're talking about today is we spent a year working with AI to up-res it to a high-definition
beautiful
movie. So, and that is available streaming VOD. It was Netflix for a while. It had a good run. But what's interesting about it is that it just gets more interesting as time goes on because it just becomes more alien bizarre about that this even existed.
And it really was for the time. We used to go to like 42nd Street, you know, and watch these nudist films from Sweden and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
It was
and even
all
in the
rage.
Drive-ins in the 70s.
Yeah.
And the titles were all jokes. Smell of Honey, Swallow of Brine, She Freak, Thar She Blows, and Epic
She Freak. She bad.
If you want to check out the movie, go to the website, maumausexx.com. That's MAUMAUSEXSEX. And you can see the trailer. And my co-conspirator on Mau Mau Sex Sex was Eddie Muller, who's been a guest on the show and is the host of the Film Noir Festival
at
the Cinematheque and is on TCM. A brilliant, brilliant man who had the same weird idea. After that, we chased crop circles in England and stumbled in.
Eddie Muller?
Eddie and I went and stumbled onto all sorts of phenomena.
Has he been on the show?
Yeah, he was on when you were out of town. MC Gainey was on that
oh,
that
boy.
Show.
Yeah, I remember now. Okay, now we were talking a little bit earlier about some psychic phenomenon that you know, in my book, Where's My Fortune Cookie, you will read about all of the bizarre connections, very much like that story you told about the Hopis, you know, where you find your path in the universe by observing things and responding to them. My favorite line from Shakespeare is from Hamlet, and it is, "The readiness is all." And that's been my philosophy in life, which is, you know, oh, wait a minute, what's happening? Where am I going now? But in my instance, really bizarre things would happen. Like the whole way that I met the Firesign, that I became part of the Firesign Theater, was because I was with Brandon DeWilde, who was a child star famous for Shane. Shane, come back, Shane! And Peter Fonda, who is famous for everything. And we went to the Sunset Strip protest for the curfew. They were trying to impose a curfew on the youth who were involved in anti-Vietnamese war protests and were, you know, openly sexual and were smoking dope on the streets in Sunset Boulevard. And so the cops decided to stop it. And they lined up the cops on one side and the sheriffs on the other, pushed everybody together to create a riot. And during that time, Fonda and Brandon and I decided we were not going to be moved. And we sat down in front of Pandora's Box, famous club at the time. And I sat on an open issue of the L.A. Free Press, which was the voice of the people in those days, pulled it out from under my butt. I had sat on Peter Bergman's face. I went to Yale with Peter Bergman. He wrote the lyrics for two musicals by Austin Pendleton that I starred in, Tom Jones and Booth Is Back in Town. So I knew who Peter Bergman, and he had made some connections when I was living down in the village. He came to visit in his army uniform with a guitar and sang protest songs. I mean, come on. So anyway, I knew who he was. But it said KPFK newsman Peter Bergman interviews returning Vietnamese war vets. Well, the next day, see, Brandon got beaten up by the cops. Peter Fonda was arrested. And I was writing for the East Village Other at that time, which is a crazy little, you know, underground paper in New York. And I was their West Coast correspondent. So I had a press card, which had a big eye on it. And I held it up, press. The cops just flowed around me like a hot knife through butter. All right. So anyway, the next day, I call up Peter Bergman. He says, yeah, I'm the Wizard of Oz. I thought, oh, man, he's gone. I said, no, I do a show called Radio Free Oz. It's a big hit on KPFK. It's on every night from blah, blah, blah. Why don't you come down and play with us? And, of course, I said yes. Wow. Because the universe was opening another door for me. And I go down there, and I meet these two other bozos, Phil Austin and David Ostman. Phil, I think, was producing the show. David Ostman was hanging out, you know. And we discovered we were all fire signs. I'm a Leo. Peter and David are Sagittarians, and Ostman, unfortunately, is an Aries. Okay, and so that was the birth of, in Peter Bergman's brain, the Firesign Theater. And I remember him saying, "We're going to be as famous as the Beatles one day," and we all kind of scoffed. You know, and by God, wouldn't you know it? One of the reviews of ours was the Beatles of comedy. You know, and we were, of course, inspired greatly by the Beatles. But bingo, there I was in a 50-year career.
Yeah.
What? Come on. And I remember—
It all started with sitting on an open
issue
face.
Of the L.A. Free Press that was open to a picture of Peter Bergman. All right.
And that's the point that the Hopis taught me, which is you have to observe because you'll see things that you don't notice.
That's
normally,
right.
Like a post-it on the wall or—
But then there are other things in the book that are totally undescribable. I went back to New York once the Firesign Theater was like starting to perform and things. We could feel something was happening. And so I went back to New York to close up my apartment on West 11th Street near the White Horse Cafe. And I was living with a wonderful gal named Diana Dew, who had invented electric clothing. She used this plastic material that would hold a charge and light up, okay? She made disco dresses and ties and other vests and things, and you could. And then she had a thing called a potentiometer on the belt, which would control how the light moved around the dress and how it flashed, so that it could move and flash in the tempo of the music. I mean, she was a genius, mm-hmm. this girl. And I was living with her and her girlfriend. Oh, those were the days, my friends, near Max's Kansas City. And, oh, man. Anyway, at a certain point, I just realized this affair is over. I got to get on with my life. And I'm sitting downstairs about ready to have this conversation with Diana. And the phone rings. And she says, "It's for you." And I pick it up. He says, "Hi, it's Peter. We just signed a contract with Columbia. We're going to do our first record. It's called Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him. We need you back here immediately. There's a ticket waiting for you at Columbia. You just go down and pick it up." Okay, there it was. Another door opened, okay, and pushed me right through it. And I came back, and by God, we did our first record, and, you know, the rest is histrionics.
You know, when I met you guys back in the 70s, I was already talking to David Ossman every week.
You were?
Yeah, because he was running the campoon, the George Papoon campaign.
Oh, yeah. David, boy, we need Papoon more than ever these days.
Boy. What a sideshow.
I know.
What a sideshow. By the way, you're listening to Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show. Ed Begley was our guest last week, and you can hear him on your favorite podcast platform, or you can go to our website,
mama.com.
Sexy Boomer. It's too much sex in all of these names. Sexyboomershow.com.
But it's important. We wouldn't be here without it.
That's right.
Right? All right, so tell me about your psychic experiences. And, oh, by the way, you mentioned earlier that you also connected with Peter Bergman as a partner for, 15 years?
I didn't think it went that long.
What were you doing with him?
We were working on Heat. We had such a good time doing our thing.
Power.
And the show got canceled. Heat got canceled. And I called you guys and said, "The show's over, but you want to keep working together?"
Yeah.
And God bless you. You said, "Yeah,
you
bet." Sure.
Oh, it was so much fun.
And so I sold the idea to a distributor in New York of a one-minute daily produced comedy bit by you guys, that would distribute to morning radio shows across the country. We did 300 of those.
Yeah.
And I was still getting...
At this time, Peter Bergman was living right up the street from where I still live on a street in Benedict Canyon.
That went on for a year, and then I realized I had to go out west because I was pitching comedy ideas to Comedy Central in New York at the time, and literally at one meeting I pitched an idea, and they said to me, "Yeah, you got to go out to California with ideas like that." Uh-huh. So I did. And I came into town and didn't really have anything going. I really only knew you and Pete. And after a couple of months, Peter said, "You know, you're a producer. I'm not. I'm a writer. You know what I do for a day job?" I said, "No." He said, "I write radio commercials for movies." And he said, "But if you could produce, maybe we could start a business together. I'll give you half my business." That was the kind of guy Peter was. And so together we built a nice business and we did hundreds of radio campaigns. So every day I had to write with Peter.
Yep.
Like we wrote 2 to 3 hours a day every day. And he was an amazing
dynamo.
Full
of ideas.
Full of ideas and full of positive energy. We had this funny rating because we would get these movies sent to us from the major studios. We did Lord of the Rings, Spider-Man. I mean, we did all the big movies. But most of them were not very good. And we'd get the VHS sent to us back in the day.
Yep.
And we'd have to watch the movie together. So we would, you know, start at 9 a.m. and we'd sit down and watch a movie not knowing what we're getting into. And we had a rating system that it was like once in a while it was like, that's pretty good. Most of the time it was like, turd. And so call it how big of a polish. You know, the expression of polishing a turd.
Polishing a turd.
And we'd look at the movie credit would end. We'd look at each other silently and look and say, heavy polish. And we'd go and write. And then every once in a while, a movie would be so weird and so bad that we would only award this once a year. It was the coveted Pig Award. Welcome to Wellville.
Oh, I remember that movie.
It was about enemas. We have to sell this.
And it was a musical, I think, too, wasn't it? That movie just flowed along beautifully.
Yeah, the movie ended, and there's just this dead silence between us. It's Lord. Like, oh, my God. Because we know we have to sit and write for 5 hours. And that's why we were at Hollywood Recording all those years.
There's a whole story about Hollywood Recording that maybe I'll tell it after I ask you about the psychic experience that is connected with your remote viewing that happened when I was there working with you. What was I doing? I was doing a voiceover for you
for
or something?
Intel radio spot.
An Intel radio spot.
And we were producing that, and we were also producing The Digital Diner, which was a sort of a Saturday Night Live radio formatted show, a 90-minute skit comedy show that we were launching.
Yeah, and we did one of those in New York, didn't we, at the Knitting Factory.
The Knitting Factory.
And my darling late wife, Melinda Peterson, was part of that.
Oh, it was great. We had all sorts of people involved.
Edie McClurg.
Saturday Night Live people.
Yeah.
We had all sorts of
people. It was a radio show, folks. Yeah. And again, Peter, the visionary, knew that there was going to be a world of audio on digitally available, mm-hmm. online. And that's
yeah,
what,
he was
a pioneer.
Yep.
And he did Radio Free Oz online with the help of John Goodman, who helped to produce executive producer, and he was engaged in all of that long before anybody else thought about podcasting mm-hmm. and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. God bless him. So anyway, we were in the studio together. Now, this was after you met the woman who taught you how to do remote
viewing? No, I had not met her yet.
You had not met her yet.
I had already I would occasionally go out and do field research, and I spent a few trips down in very rural Alabama where I had – when I was working at NBC, I was producing radio hourly newscasts for NBC Mutual and out of Washington. And something came over the wire about this remote place in Alabama that had 36 cattle mutilations in 3 months.
Oh, that's a mystery.
UFO sighting.
Still don't know what that's
about. No one
knew
what it was. And I found that intriguing. So I contacted the police department down there and had them on my radio show in New York. And the police officer who investigated said, you know, you should come down here sometime and I'll show you around.
Oh, boy.
And I did. I went down. And spent a whole night on this very creepy, at the time, very frightening place. And I was taken to some very interesting people, including one guy who just, he said, you have to meet this guy. It was a newspaper publisher and his wife and then this gentleman. And he lived in a trailer in this park in the middle of nowhere where the Trail of Tears originated. And they still heard the Indian children in the cave.
Trail of Tears trailer park. That's Fireside Theater. That's, oh my God.
Anyway. So I got to know this police officer. He was actually from he had this southern accent when I interviewed him, you know.
Well, I hope he did. He did come from there.
So I said, well, I'm coming down. He says, great. We'll drive around in the police car all night, and I'll show you all the weird spaces. And I was like, good, because I'm not going to sleep while I'm there. And as the night goes on, his accent drops.
Oh, yeah?
It was really weird. It's like the southern cop just his – and he took me to his boss, the sheriff, who was like – Boss Hogg.
Yeah.
Huge southern sheriff.
Oh.
It was police chief, actually. And he said, you know what? I'm the only liberal around here.
No kidding.
Because I was from New York and he was proud.
Oh, my
And he
gosh.
Told me how they had seen so many UFOs there that they had nicknames for it. Big Bertha.
Oh.
Big Bertha. I said, what's Big Bertha? He said, oh, she's about 300 feet across, silent, flies over you, come over the house a bunch of times. He had a name for another one called, it was 900 feet across.
Oh, my God.
And I ended up having tracked triangular-shaped craft from New York all the way into Florida, interviewing police officers, you know, professional trained observers who had seen the same thing. I never put it together, but I went to this small rural area, Sand Mountain, and they were so familiar. It was like Mayberry RFD meets The Outer Limits.
Well, it sounds like that scene from Close Encounters where the people are all waiting for the little guys to go zipping by.
Yeah.
Really? Oh, my God.
And they were so accustomed to high strangeness.
Yeah.
Creatures, cattle mutilations, strange aircraft, unmarked silent helicopters.
Wow.
That they... They literally looked at me and said, why did you come all the way down here? You know, it was nothing special to them.
Wow.
Anyway, this cop that's chauffeuring me around, he starts losing his accent. I said, wait, where are you from? He said, Berkeley. I said, Berkeley? I said, what are you talking about? He goes, yeah, I'd go deep cover. I have military police background, so I am doing a UFO documentary, and I've been all around the country, and I met someone who really was plugged in. He told me to come up here and bring a camera.
But he really is a policeman? Or
he got a job because they had the 36 cattle mutilations were such a problem for the ranchers because they couldn't get insurance back from it.
Sure.
So his name was Ted as well, and he said, if you hire me, I have a military police background, if you hire me, send me to the academy, I'll go on staff and I'll just devote myself to having official investigative powers find out what's going on. And he really dug deep.
Wow.
That was how good he was. So he eventually left and went back to Berkeley. And he called me one day and he said, hey, and he had this gift of meeting people, connecting people. And he said, I met this woman who was head of the Mensa Society in the Bay Area. Okay. And the Mensa is a genius society.
Yeah.
She's supposedly
smart.
Yeah. She's supposed to be one of the best remote viewers in the country. And I said, what do you mean?
What is that?
Remote viewing. I said, oh, yeah, I've heard of that. He said, I'm going to have lunch with her. I said, what do you want me to do? Stand on a street corner at a prescribed time? She goes, I don't know. I'll let you know.
Yeah.
I won't get into the whole story because we don't have all that time. But she hit one point in lunch in Berkeley, and I was in Santa Monica. He turned to her and said, okay, mind if we do something? She goes, sure. She says, okay, my friend, he might have said my name, but not where I was. What's he doing right now? And he called me back 2 hours later and said, what were you doing 2 hours before? I said, I know exactly what I was doing. I was going through I had just moved to L.A. and I had a room full of boxes, and a friend from L.A., Joe from Chicago, had asked me to look for a cassette, which was like looking for a needle in a haystack. And I was really, frustrated and annoyed by it and, thinking like, God, this is a waste of time. It's a waste of time. And I finally gave up. He goes, oh, my God. I said, what? She goes, I can't believe that. I said, what? She said, he's in a room full of boxes and he's angry at someone.
Huh?
And she said that the person that you were angry was had she described Joe to a T.
Oh my God.
She didn't know me, she didn't know Joe, she didn't even know where I was. I said, well, that's pretty impressive. He goes, damn, yeah, let me do it again. I said, okay, let me know. So the second time we set it up when she had lunch, he said, remember what you're doing at noon. And that's when we were working together in Hollywood.
At Fred Jones.
And I came in at noon exactly. And I was handed a bunch of scripts from all the writers on the comedy show. And I said, great, I'll look them over. I got to go downstairs to work on the intel spot. I go down, and that's where you were there.
Yeah.
So I didn't even remember what he said. So a couple hours later, he calls me at the station, at the studio, and said, okay, what were you doing at noon? I said, oh, man, I forgot. Wait a minute. Hold on. I know exactly what I was doing. I know exactly where I was. He said, okay, this time she sketched what she saw.
She drew it.
What she saw? I said, okay. So he faxes me this sketch. And I said to you, Phil, this is crazy. You want to go upstairs and see if this matches up? We went upstairs and we stood where I stood. And we looked at the drawing and she drew exactly the hallway, the same number of doors,
yes,
an alcove to the right, which I hadn't even noticed, with a stack of newspapers on it, which were there.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Remember, I called my friend back. I said, all right, what's her number? Yeah. And I called her and I said, wow, you seem to know me. She was this lovely Texan woman.
Uh-huh.
And she said, oh, well, you're very good at it. You're a natural transmitter. I said, what are you talking about? I said, can I come up and have lunch with you? And she said, sure. And we had lunch in Berkeley. And after lunch, she said, she talked to me about it. She goes, would you like to come over and take a lesson? I said, really? She goes, yeah, I don't empower a-holes, so I wanted to have lunch with you first.
Wow.
She took me over and she taught me how to do it. And she proved it to me on this first lesson that I could do it. I studied with her for a few months, and basically what it is, I guess, is you're honing your third eye, if you will, your intuitive sense that we kind of lose touch with technology. Your brain doesn't do anything it doesn't have to do, right?
Right.
And so she taught me how to manipulate time and space. She taught me how to remote view. And she said it's very common. Some people are better at it than others, but it's quite common.
Wow.
And we did things that blew my mind here and off planet, where I was skeptical. She said, all right, meet me in Orange County. I have an advanced student. I think you're good enough to be there with us. And I go to this tract home in Orange County, and it's this lovely homemaker. Yeah. And she invites us in, and they said, let's go out and do it in the backyard. So what you do when you get into a remote viewing situation, you hold hands in a circle, and that's how you connect energetically. You close your eyes, and you go into basically a shamanic account, where you ground yourself.
Okay.
And usually the teacher leads the discussion. You just keep – and it's very, very, very few words. Just, okay, we're leaving. We're going to go. We're going off the planet. We're going to another place. take a look. We're there.
She's guiding.
But she's not tipping you. She's not tipping you off.
Okay.
And I immediately came to, and it's like daydreaming. And she said, it's not daydreaming. It feels like daydreaming. I was like, I feel like I'm just making this up. Well, you're not. I see a verdant planet, like a rainforest-covered planet. Beautiful, just beautiful green.
Mm.
Oh, and before we started it, there was a dog barking like two doors down in the backyard.
Yeah.
And she just calmly said, let's have the dog quiet down. Dog stops barking.
Oh, I love
now,
it.
Now, whether it stopped barking or we, who knows? But it stopped.
Okay.
We come back. Fortunately, she doesn't ask me first of what I saw.
Yeah.
So the advanced student says, well, what I saw was a lot of green. It was like a forest.
Oh.
It was like a planet. It was steamy.
Could it have been early Earth?
I don't know, but I did this several times. Women were really very intrigued by this, and women would always say, look at me at a particular time. Tell me what you see. It's like, okay.
Now, did you have to go into a meditative state to do this?
Yeah. Very, very, very casually.
A light
and very quickly.
State.
Yeah, it's not – it's just really just –
Can you still
focusing.
Do it?
I suppose. I did a few experiments like manipulating time because it's all perception.
Okay. If you want to see Ted manipulating time over the radio –
Okay, Phil, you've been going on for an hour on this manipulating time thing.
Time just flies when you're manipulating it. All right.
And we have lots of guests coming up.
And, yes, we do.
We have some interesting shows coming up. And you can hear all of our past shows on our website, sexyboomershow.com.
.com. So come and enjoy them.
And if you listen to podcasts, they're on all your platforms.
We're going to have Jamie Alcroft and his wife, Sarah Karahawa, and they're going to, and possibly his rock star daughter,
Haley Kiyoko. That would be.
Yeah, because it's part of our investigation of families. You know, we had Leonard Maltin and his lovely wife, Alice, on the show. It was great fun.
And we're talking about Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show here on our website afterwards, so you can hear everything. Oh, we're told to stretch.
Oh, all right. I know, because sitting, it's hard on your back, isn't it? Well, I tell you, Ted, this has been fun. We could do this again.
Let's face it. If our listener will put up with it.
Yeah.
Phil, always a pleasure.
Ted, always more of a pleasure. Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show.
We'll see you next week.
And now you know the rest of the story.